Welcome to 88 Diagnoses, your shortcut to being well-informed. Imagine this. You're a resident, maybe just coming off a long shift, and you walk into a clinic in a resource-limited setting. There's a surge of patients. And the common threat, acute diarrheal diseases. We're talking about something that contributes to, what, over 1.5 million deaths globally each year? And nearly 7 billion cases. The stakes are just incredibly high. So what do? This deep dive is all about tackling acute diarrhea in adults in these challenging settings. Understanding it, assessing it, managing it effectively. Our mission today, to get you ready, give you the essentials so you can hit the wards running, feeling prepared. Okay, let's unpack this. So to start off, we all kind of know the textbook definition of diarrhea. But in these settings, the clinical distinctions seem absolutely critical, like duration and character. How do you use those right off the bat to guide your thinking?
That's exactly the right place to start. I mean, sure, diarrhea is broadly, you know, loose or watery stools maybe 3 or more times in 24 hours. But the real clinical leverage comes from classifying it. Is it acute, less than 14 days? Or has it become persistent, you know, 14 to 30 days, or even chronic, over 30 days? But maybe the most crucial distinction for your immediate assessment is it watery diarrhea, non-bloody? Or is it invasive diarrhea, dysentery? Meaning, can you see visible blood? That single finding visible blood, often with fever, maybe abdominal pain, that's a huge pivot point. It changes everything in your approach.
Right, that bloody versus watery distinction really sets the scene. And thinking about the scale,
yeah,
it's just overwhelming, isn't it? The global burden.
It really is staggering. You mentioned the 1.5 million deaths in 2019, the billions of cases annually, and the impact on kids. It's heartbreaking. About 10% of deaths in children under 5. Now, things have improved, better sanitation, the widespread use of oral rehydration solution, ORS, that's made a huge dent in mortality. But the sheer volume, it's still an immense challenge, especially where resources are tight and outbreaks can happen right on top of the usual endemic cases.
So for you, the resident, patient walks in, what are those like common risk factors that should immediately flash acute diarrhea in your mind, especially in these high burden places?
Yeah, good question. A lot of it boils down to the environment. Think about crowding, our refugee camps, maybe unplanned urban settlements, limited clean water, poor sanitation. It's just a perfect storm for spreading disease quickly. Contaminated food and water are obviously huge drivers. And some bugs, like Shigella dysenteriae, they spread person to person incredibly easily. Now, another really critical factor you'll often encounter is HIV infection. Patients with HIV or AIDS can get more frequent, more severe infections from certain enteric bacteria, things like Campylobacter, Salmonella, Shigella, certain E. coli, Vibrio. Non-typhoidal salmonellosis, for example, can be really nasty in these patients. But here's a key on the wards tip. Even if your patient is HIV positive, always start by considering the common causes of infectious diarrhea first. Don't jump straight to the zebra.
Okay, that makes sense. Don't let the comorbidity blinker you.
Exactly. If you can't remember everything from this section, remember this. It's not just the definition. Recognizing visible blood fundamentally shifts your clinical approach in these settings. That's your crucial pivot. And always factor in the environment and HIV status when thinking about risk.
All right, groundwork laid. Now let's put on our detective hats. You're there. Maybe the lab is minimal or non-existent.
Yeah.
What are the usual microbial suspects? And how do you start to figure out what you're dealing with?
That's the reality, isn't it? In most cases, you won't get a specific microbiologic diagnosis, and often you don't strictly need one for the initial management. You rely heavily on the clinical picture. Is this part of a bigger outbreak or just an isolated case? And critically, again, watery or bloody diarrhea, those clues are vital.
You mentioned outbreaks. Can you clarify that a bit? Like epidemic versus endemic pathogens, and which ones are the real heavy hitters we need to be ready for in an epidemic?
Sure. So an epidemic is basically a sudden spike in cases, more than you'd normally expect. An outbreak is similar, but maybe more localized geographically. When we talk about epidemic diarrhea, two organisms really dominate. First, Shigella species. There are four main species, but what makes them so dangerous in outbreaks is their incredibly low infective dose. Like, maybe just 10 to 100 organisms can make someone sick.
Well, that's tiny.
It is. And that means person-to-person spread is super easy, especially where it's crowded. And for you, the resident, the other crucial thing is their increasing antimicrobial resistance. That's a huge global problem and makes treatment tricky.
Okay, Shigella resistance, low dose. Got it. Who's the second big player?
That would be Vibrio cholerae. This one causes that classic severe secretory diarrhea because of the toxins it produces, massive fluid loss. The O1 serogroup is the most common culprit worldwide, and lots of places are endemic for cholera, meaning they have cases pretty regularly, maybe seeing outbreaks seasonally. Less often, you might see enterohemorrhagic E. coli causing epidemics too, usually bloody diarrhea.
So those are the big outbreak concerns. What about the diarrhea that's not part of a massive epidemic? You know, the more sporadic day-to-day cases you're likely seeing.
Right. For just straightforward acute watery diarrhea, non-epidemic, the most common cause by far is enterotoxigenic E. coli, ETEC. You also see things like norovirus, campylobacter, non-typhoidal salmonella, aeromonas. And V. cholerae can cause these non-epidemic cases too, especially seasonally. Now, for acute bloody diarrhea, non-epidemic, again, Shigenoa species are really important, especially S. flexneri, though S. sonnei is increasingly common globally. But you also need to think about Campylobacter jejuni, other types of E. coli, like enteroinvasive and non-typhoidal salmonella. And don't forget Entamoeba histolytica. Again, the big challenge with Shigella here is that resistance issue.
That's quite the rogues gallery.
Yeah.
But the on-the-words tip I'm hearing loud and clear is, outbreak or not, just quickly sorting out watery versus bloody gives you a massive head start, even without labs. It's like your first big filter.
Exactly. If you can't remember everything here, remember this. Shigella and V. cholerae are the big epidemic players. Think low dose, think resistance. For everyday watery diarrhea, think ETEC. For everyday bloody diarrhea, think Shigella. Always start with watery or bloody.
Okay, bringing it back to the bedside. Busy clinic, pressure's on. How do you quickly tell the difference between, say, severe cholera and shigellosis? What are those classic clues residents need to spot?
This is where sharp clinical observation is key. For cholera, you're looking for that profuse, non-bloody rice water stool. Often has little flecks of mucus. It's pretty distinct. Onset is sudden, often vomiting, some cramping, but usually not severe abdominal pain or tenesmus, that painful straining feeling. Fever's uncommon, too.
Okay. Rice water, no fever, sudden onset. Cholera.
Right. Now contrast that with shigellosis. That typically presents with frequent, small volume liquid stools, almost always with visible blood, maybe mucus, abdominal cramps, tenesmus, fever, feeling unwell, loss of appetite. Those are classic for Shigella.
So they sound quite different in the classic presentation.
They do, classically. But here's the crucial caveat, especially for you on the wards. While these descriptions are helpful, particularly during an outbreak, you often cannot definitively pinpoint the specific bug based only on signs and symptoms, especially within those broad watery versus bloody categories. Like, you can't always reliably tell shigellosis apart from other causes of bloody diarrhea just by looking at the patient. It keeps you on your toes.
Right. So beyond the diarrhea itself, what are the really urgent, life-threatening things we need to be watching for? What puts the patient in immediate danger?
Number one, without a doubt, is severe volume depletion, dehydration. That is your absolute top priority to assess and manage immediately. You'll see signs of moderate dehydration, intense thirst, restlessness, maybe irritability, skin that tense when you pinch it, sunken eyes. If it gets severe, you're looking at decreased consciousness, maybe even coma. The patient can't drink, their pulse might be absent, or thready and really fast.
And that's more cholera than Shigella.
Generally, yes, massive fluid loss is the hallmark of cholera. It's usually less pronounced with Shigella. Interestingly, though, with Shigella, you sometimes see hyponatremia, low sodium, possibly due to SIADH. So that's something specific to keep in mind.
Okay, dehydration first. What else? Other serious complications?
Definitely. You need to think about bacteria in the bloodstream, especially with non-typhoidal salmonella in HIV patients. Hemolytic uremic syndrome, HUS, that's a nasty complication affecting blood and kidneys, can happen with Shigella or certain E. coli. There's Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS, the neurological disorder, sometimes linked to Campylobacter, reactive arthritis too. And specifically with severe Shigella, watch out for things like sepsis, seizures, rectal prolapse, even toxic metacolon.
Wow. Okay. So patient presents. What's the immediate practical assessment, step by step, for the resident?
First steps are always history and physical exam. Your main goals right then are classify the diarrhea type watery or bloody. And critically, assess the severity of dehydration. How much fluid have they lost? The WHO has simple, useful classifications. No dehydration, maybe up to 4% body weight loss. Some dehydration, 5 to 10% loss. That's where you see the thirst, restlessness, poor skin turgor, sunken eyes, and severe dehydration, more than 10% loss. That's the patient with altered consciousness, maybe no urine output, cool skin, thready or absent pulse. You assess these signs quickly.
And labs. When do they actually help, especially if resources are limited?
Right. Labs aren't usually needed for uncomplicated watery diarrhea.
Yeah.
But when you can get them, they can be useful. Routine stool microscopy on a fresh sample is great. Finding fecal leukocytes, red blood cells that point strongly towards an invasive bacterial infection.
Oh.
And here's a really key nuance, a ward pearl for you. If you see Entamoeba trophozoites under the microscope and they are packed with ingested red blood cells, that's enough to treat for amoebic dysentery. But, and this is important, just finding cysts or trophozoites without those ingested red blood cells, that's not enough. Asymptomatic carriage is common.
That's a critical distinction, trophozoites with RBCs.
Exactly. For cholera, if you have dark field microscopy, you might see the shooting stars motility. Or there are rapid dipstick tests now. Serum electrolytes, glucose. Not routine, but definitely consider them if you see red flags, like an ileus, slow heart rate, confusion, seizures, or if someone's extremely thirsty and agitated, or not making urine even after you start fluids.
Okay, so the big on the wards tip here feels like it's hammering home that initial assessment.
Absolutely. If there's one thing you take away today, it's this. Your absolute priority, before you even think hard about which bug it is to rapidly assess hydration status. That assessment drives your immediate life-saving actions.
If you can't remember everything, remember this. Cholera and shigellosis have classic signs, yes, but always confirm hydration status first. That dictates immediate management. And remember the specific clue for amoebic dysentery. Trophozoites stuffed with red blood cells. Okay, we've identified the problem. Assess the patient. Now, the action. How do we treat these patients effectively, especially with limited resources? What are the core principles you need to master?
The core principles are actually quite simple, but incredibly powerful. One, correct fluid and electrolyte losses. Two, provide nutrition, antibiotics. They play a role, but it's selective.
Fluid replacement, we know it's critical, but what kind? How much?
Rehydration is the absolute cornerstone. For patients with no dehydration or just some dehydration, oral rehydration salts, ORS, are fantastic. Highly effective. The Warnicef reduced osmolarity ORS, the one with 75 millicuol sodium, 75 millimol glucose, that's the standard. It's a game changer because it significantly cuts down the need for IV fluids compared to older formulas.
Right, the low osmolarity one.
Exactly. Now, if you have severe dehydration, you need intravenous fluids. Stat. Preferred choices are Ringer's lactate. You can add 5% dextrose if needed, or something called cholera saline or DOCA solution. Normal saline works in a pinch, but it's not ideal because it doesn't have potassium, which patients lose a lot of, and it doesn't have a base like lactate to help correct acidosis.
Okay, fluid sorted. Now, the question I know I always had as a resident, does everyone with diarrhea need antibiotics? Seems like they get handed out a lot sometimes.
That's such a crucial question. And the answer for most watery diarrhea is a clear no. Most acute watery diarrhea resolves on its own. Antibiotics generally don't shorten it or change the outcome significantly. The major exception is severe cholera, especially during an outbreak. In that specific situation, the right antibiotic can dramatically shorten the illness duration and reduce the sheer volume of diarrhea. That's a huge help when you're managing lots of patients.
Okay, so severe cholera in an outbreak, yes. But crucial caveat.
Crucial caveat. Use local susceptibility data to choose that antibiotic. Cholera resistance is a growing problem.
And what about dysentery? The bloody diarrhea.
That's different. For adults with bloody diarrhea, especially if they're older or have AIDS, you should treat promptly with an antibiotic that covers Shigella. And again, I have to sound like a broken record here, but local susceptibility data is paramount. You need to know what works in your area.
What if you don't have that data?
If you're flying blind, reasonable empiric choices might be ciprofloxacin or azithromycin. But watch closely. Drug resistance is so common with Shigella. If your patient isn't getting better after 48 hours or if they get worse sooner, you must switch to a different drug. And if they still don't respond, or if that stool microscopy showed those Entamoeba trophozoites packed with red blood cells, then you treat for amoebic dysentery, usually metronidol, followed by an agent to clear cysts from the gut.
And you mentioned resistance several times. It really sounds like a massive issue with these bugs.
It's a huge global crisis, honestly, especially with enteric pathogens, misuse, overuse of antibiotics. It's fueled widespread multi-drug resistance in non-typhoidal salmonella, in Shigella, in V. cholerae. This seriously complicates things, especially for severe cases or during big outbreaks. It just underscores why knowing your local resistance patterns is non-negotiable. Always try to base treatment on recent local data.
What about diet? Should patients eat, starve the diarrhea?
No, definitely don't starve them. A simple but important point. Keep providing nutritious food. As soon as the patient can tolerate it, encourage small, frequent meals. Early feeding helps the gut recover.
Makes sense. And finally, the big picture prevention. How do we stop this cycle? What are the key things that actually work?
Prevention is absolutely key, and it involves some basics that are incredibly powerful. Hand washing with soap consistently, safe drinking water, safe food handling, promoting breastfeeding for babies, proper disposal of human waste sanitation is huge, controlling flies.
Yeah.
We also have tools like oral cholera vaccines. There are licensed ones, even a global stockpile. And there's ongoing work on Shigella vaccines, which is really promising. These public health efforts are just as critical as treating individual patients.
Okay, a lot to take in there.
Absolutely. If you can't remember everything about treatment, remember this. Rehydration, ORS, or IV is the absolute foundation. Antibiotics are not routine for watery diarrhea, except severe cholera in outbreaks. They are generally needed for dysentery, but always let local resistance data guide you. And prevention through hygiene and sanitation is vital.
So pulling it all together, what does this mean for you, the resident, when you're actually there? Clinic's packed, pressure's high.
Yeah.
It raises that crucial question, right? How do you synthesize all this information when a real patient is right in front of you needing help now?
Yeah, exactly. It's about putting the pieces together under pressure.
Okay, let's try a quick scenario. Let's really put this into practice. Imagine this. You're viewing a 30-year-old man. He's come in with acute, severe watery diarrhea. Says he's had maybe 15, 20 loose, non-bloody stools in just the last 12 hours. He's alert, but complaining of intense thirst. You see sunken eyes, his skin turgor is decreased. Pulse is rapid, maybe 110, thready. BP is lowish, 90, 60. So you rapidly classify him, severe hypovolemia. You immediately start IV Ringer's lactate, running it in quickly. Good start. Now, after about 2 hours of rapid IV fluids, his pulse and BP are improving slightly. But suddenly, he develops generalized muscle weakness. He seems a bit confused, altered mental status. What's your immediate next step? And what critical electrolyte imbalance should be flashing in your mind right now, given the massive fluid losses and the rapid rehydration you've started? Think about those labs we said weren't always routine. That's the kind of twist you might actually see, isn't it? It really tests if you're thinking beyond just replacing the volume.
It absolutely does. It forces you to integrate everything, the initial presentation, the potential complications of both the disease and the treatment. We really encourage you, take these ideas, these principles, apply them next time you're on rounds. Talk about these cases, these nuances with your senior residents, with your attendings. Delve deeper when you see a patient like this. Your experience, your critical thinking, it truly makes a difference.
Absolutely. Join us next time on 88 Diagnoses for another deep dive into essential medical knowledge.